You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Jürgen Moltmann once famously said at a conference, "Without women preachers, we'd have no knowledge of the resurrection." He's acknowledging here the key role that Mary plays in both our gospel readings for this week as announcer of the good news that he is risen and as one commissioned by Jesus to go tell.
Hi everyone, it's Fran here. It's our Easter Sunday episode and we will be looking at the 1 Corinthians 15 reading and looking at the resurrection accounts in both Mark and John, Mark 16, 1-8 and John 20, 1-18. And we're going to go chronologically, which means we are going to begin with the 1 Corinthians 15 passage.
Yes. So Paul here gives us one of the first written accounts we have of the resurrection, and it comes to us in already an almost formulaic way that readers will recognise from the creeds, because this language is almost directly verbatim in the creeds a couple of hundred years later.
Yep.
But of course, 1 Corinthians was written probably in the late 40s, early 50s, so a couple of decades before the Gospels.
Yeah, that's an historical fact that I think it's worth people noting.
Mm. We might also note who's not in Paul's account, which is any of the women.
Yes.
But we will get to them in a moment with the Gospels. So we hear it. This is towards the end of this letter. And in some ways, chapter 15 is a famous chapter for the unpacking of the resurrection. So he'll go on to talk about the significance of it. But I think it's worth noting at the outset that this is framed as good news. So whatever we do on Easter Sunday, we're proclaiming good news. This is the Sunday for joy and all of those lovely things.
Yeah, and it's also a day when you're quite likely to have visitors coming in, and that should influence in sort of the delivery of what you're doing, I think.
I think so. It's a tricky Sunday to preach in some ways because you want enough substance for your regular churchgoers.
Yes.
Who need more than just the basic retelling of the story. But it also needs to be accessible and probably punchy and to the point for any visitors, the grandkids, the people who get dragged along on Easter Sunday
and
services.
I mean, I would say the visitors need to hear more than the retelling as well. It's one of those things where you go, no, it's not a time for explaining, like we say on Trinity Sunday.
Yep.
But I think it is a time increasingly where we might not be explaining, but we don't assume huge amounts of knowledge, like historical facts, like that Corinthians came before the Gospels. And that's important because there's all these aspects of the narrative in the Gospels that Paul is not remotely interested in.
Yes.
But this is the first handing on of the tradition.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so therefore, you know, should we get hung up on historicity questions around the resurrection if they were actually secondary to what was handed on in the tradition in Corinthians, for example?
Yes. And for me too, I take your point, we don't need to explain it, and it's not about getting into the nitty-gritty of what actually happened, because quite frankly science fails to make any account of this. It's purely the point at which faith steps in the Christian tradition. But I think we do need to be careful in our language that we're not communicating this is some kind of resuscitation.
Oh, yeah, or a magic trick or something.
Yeah, magic, or he wasn't really dead and revived. So the language we use is really important for what we are and are not communicating. I know in some traditions that are a bit more progressive lean this way, but I don't think it's also helpful to talk about this as some sort of, you know, metaphorical or psychological resurrection.
Well, we'll see.
That's certainly not what Paul thinks.
No, and it's certainly not what comes through in the Luke, anywhere, because he's quite bodily there, tasting, talking and so on.
Yep.
I do think it is a time for creative uses of language around resurrection. So seeing it, one way of thinking of it, as a judgment. So our judgment of God was the cross.
Yep.
And God's response was the resurrection. Judging our judgment, which was a...
By ours, you mean human judgment?
Yes.
Yes.
Human
okay.
judgment. That this is a profound no to... Well, it's a yes to us.
Yes.
It's a loud yes to our violent no.
Yes.
In the cross. That there's...
It's a no to the violence and death of the cross and the oppression and all that's layered on.
And to our arrogance.
Yes.
And a yes to life, to a fundamentally different order of things, to the first being last, to possibility where we don't see it.
Yeah.
You know, life possibility where we don't see it.
Yep, exactly. So let's get into this text a bit, Fran. I don't know what details you noticed, but I couldn't help but notice in this chronology that really Paul retells here, which again I think is quite formulaic. He appeared first to Cephas, which is Peter,
mm-hmm.
And we'll see in the John reading and in the Gospels there's a primacy of Peter seeing first, even though Mary is there first.
Yes.
But, you know, whatever. Mm. and then the 12, and then 500 brothers and sisters. And Paul notes this nice little thing, some of whom are still alive, which is his little like, you know, you can go ask
you can
them.
Go check.
There's some proof. And then James, and then all the apostles, and all the apostles for Paul would include women, we should say, because he calls Junia an apostle, so apostles are women too. And then, of course, this is all self-referential, which everything in Paul really is, which is this very strange phrase, which we won't get bogged down on because it's not really the topic for an Easter Sunday sermon, but to one untimely born, and the language is here as to one miscarried, like born early. Or born out of time. So it's a very strange phrase that's either referring to like...
Is it his prophetic?
No, I think it's saying... He's either saying something about himself in terms of like as one sort of monstrous, like an early birth is often not pretty to look at in terms of, you know, his inferiority, or that he's born out of time in the sense that he's an apostle later by virtue of seeing Jesus in his risen form, but not one of those early. Oh. So he's kind of out of step with time.
Yeah, no. Anyway,
but that's not it's the not, point. Not the point really, of your Sunday sermon.
But the word appeared.
Yes.
We have to talk about.
Yeah, we do.
Because I think that's something worth pointing out in your sermon, particularly if there's visitors there, but generally anyway, that the word resurrection isn't used here.
No,
he talks about rising again, but he's is the language of appearance, and it's not just that it's the language of appearance, it's that it's in the passive voice. So this is not Paul's effort or special wisdom that is making Jesus appear to him or making him see or encounter Jesus. It's entirely the movement of Jesus
towards
Paul.
Yep.
He appeared, and there's also the word mystery can be lazily used, but there is an element of that. Like he appeared, not he came by this way, or I saw him do this and this, and he did it this way.
Yeah.
Just he appeared. So I would want to say one thing to talk to your communities about is that technically speaking, you know, a question, does the church believe in the resurrection? Well, yes, but or... in the continued presence of the risen Lord.
Mm.
That's actually what we're
proclaiming,
the continued presence of the crucified one amongst us. And that Paul provides that language and that framework in this reading to talk that way.
Yeah, I really like that. And, I mean, I prefer the translation almost he was seen by, because it makes that point,
it is a passive verb.
Yeah. But what I like in this lineage is, you know, it's the same language for then, you know, he appeared to Paul or was seen by Paul. And, of course, we know Paul only had these – I shouldn't say only. His only encounter with Jesus is as a kind of resurrected visionary experience, like the Damascus Road experience. Mm. So we have – it goes to your point, I think, which is we don't have to have seen the historical Jesus or the resurrected as he appeared to the disciples. The point is we can share that same experience of kind of seeing God. Mm. And it raises the question, where do we continue to recognize and see God in the way you've outlined? I like to, despite all this emphasis on sight, which again is very Greco-Roman, it's how you encountered the gods is visually through visions and statuary and stuff in other traditions. It still ends with proclamation. Paul, you know, ends in verse 11, you know, whether it was I or they, so we proclaim and so you have come to believe. And we're going to see that echoed again in the Gospels. It's about proclaiming this and people come to believe.
And also, yes, so that something transformative, something resurrecting happens in the act of proclamation.
Yes.
That it's not the bringing back of something in the past, it's the thing now appearing.
Yeah. And I think ultimately our task on Easter Sunday, easier said than done, I'll acknowledge, is to testify to where we see the appearance of Jesus or to testify to that presence.
To the hope that is stronger than the despair you see around you.
Yep. So turning now to Mark 16, the lectionary gives us the last eight verses of Mark, and the scholarly consensus is that Mark ends at 16:8 with that very short, strange sentence, "For they were afraid." Fran, what did you notice about the Markan reading, or what struck you as distinct here? I do love Mark's ending, I have to say, for its starkness and strangeness.
The general theme of alarm and fear that I suppose I'm struck particularly in the John reading by that. We haven't got to that yet. Alarmed and...
Yep. I think for me, well, maybe we should unpack the story a little bit too. We've got Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome. We don't really know a lot about those other women, but a group of women coming with spices. And from what we know of first century Jewish burial practices, normally you would use spices and ointments when you wrapped the body for burial. This alludes to probably a historic reality that Jesus' body was brought down on that Friday quite quickly and they had to bury him before the Sabbath started, and perhaps that some of those steps were missed. And, of course, spices and things were used not least to just – hide the smell when you weren't, in an ancient time. But the fact they bring spices, I mean, we've got this movement here between faith and doubt, because the fact that they bring the spices means they're still expecting a dead body, right? That's the expectation.
But then they're redirected.
Yeah.
He's been raised, don't look here.
Yes. So for me... there's two exegetical things to note in Mark. The one is the inclusion of Peter by name in verse 7. Go tell his disciples and Peter. We have to ask why Peter is named. Surely he is one of the disciples. But I think it's because Peter, last time we encountered him, denied Christ. So maybe there's a question in this early Christian community. If you deny Christ, have you stopped being a disciple? And Mark is saying, no, Peter's included, denying Christ. And maybe in the context of martyrdom and persecution of Christians, denying Christ does not mean you cannot return to be a disciple.
Yeah, we did make that point a few weeks ago, didn't we, with the get behind me, Satan, that was directed to Peter. And it's not a statement of eviction. It's actually get back in line to follow behind me.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this is almost like the third call to Peter to kind of get back in the group. And of course, then the message to, you know, he's gone ahead of you to Galilee, and Galilee is the part where it all begins. In Mark, we should point out we don't have a vision of Jesus. We just have testimony. He's been raised and they're supposed to believe it. So we don't have sight. We have testimony. But the invitation to all of them, placed in Mary's, you know, commissioned, Mary's commission to be the bearer of this message, is to return to Galilee and kind of start again.
To start the proclamation again, or to start the ministry of Jesus as the church.
I think so. So I think Mark is quite – so this is a very different sermon if you preach on Mark, where, you know, Mark's gospel ends in this really strange, abrupt way, but I think it's an invitation to almost say, okay, readers – over to you now. Jesus is inviting us all to meet him in Galilee and to kind of pick up the ministry with him. This is our place to enter the story.
Ending with fear is peculiar.
It is peculiar because there's a tension, right? Mary is on the one hand, and this is why I wanted to start with the Jürgen Moltmann quote, because on the one hand he's right. Mary must have said something at some point. But Mark tells us, like, you know, the women fled and said nothing to anyone.
The secret.
So even the women also fail in Mark, but at some point they told someone something.
It'd be interesting to preach about whether what's happened to our fear. I mean, Fear's not great. But there's something about the awe and the wonder that is within that fear at this traumatic event and how we might have lost that in our rationalizing or our sense of how the world should be ordered, and it's not ordered that way. So we've lost the wonder of the encounter, or have we? We'll talk a bit about that.
Yeah. I've come around to thinking, I used to think that terror and amazement as a pairing were really strange because they seemed contradictory. But I now sometimes wonder that when we have a truly profound experience of any kind, I mean, including spiritual, but just these kind of aha moments or something, or we've achieved something we never thought we'd achieve, or something's been revealed to us by a friend or whatever, there can be a kind of an amazement at that, but also a fear for what it means. Mm. Like, it can accompany those.
I was thinking that's possibly also sometimes the emotion. You know, we talked the other week about Paul's framing of grace and repentance and forgiveness, that it's the recognition of the joy and the gift from God that makes you realize the death and fearsomeness of where you were. So it's the experience of grace that brings into sharp relief what was wrong, to put it in very basic terms. And there is a terror and amazement, depending on the situation. Yeah. Actually, there's that. That's where the pairing can happen too.
Yes. It always makes me think of, I think it's towards the end of Nelson Mandela's book where he talks, he actually quotes what I think is a Marilyn Robinson poem. I should have checked that. About, you know, we're not afraid of our darkness, we're afraid of our light. In other words, we're afraid of what – and that sense that sometimes in the midst of call and commissioning, and I think clergy and others who've had some vocational experience might recognize this, there is both a sense of wonder that God is asking us to do this thing and that we could be chosen. We could be that significant to God to be chosen. And the accompanying terror, which is entirely appropriate about, like, oh, how on earth, what could I do, you know, which, of course, is all through the Bible when people are called.
Yeah, I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
I can't speak properly. What would you make of the who will roll away the stone question? Is that just there to underline the impossibility from the human side of what's happened here, or?
Yeah, I think in Mark we've got to remember all the disciples don't get it. We've had all the men flee. The women have hung in there at the cross, but now even we're seeing that the women who followed have not quite got it. So I think it is setting up this, you know, the fact they bring spices and then they're musing on who will move the stone. They are not expecting anything else than a tomb and haven't quite planned ahead. And so when they see that the stone has been moved, that's the first sort of disruption, if you like, of expectations that says something's gone on here.
Mm. And so perhaps their retrospective answer to themselves would be God.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
We should also note, if you are going to preach on Mark, again, get the language right. It's a young man, not an angel. What that means, I don't really know. There's a young man who runs away after the Garden of Gethsemane. So
he's come back.
I don't know. It's one of those curiosities in Mark that I kind of find delightful but also annoying because I don't know. But he's dressed in white, so it's possible he is meant to be some kind of angelic messenger, but he's not called an angel. He's a young man who points the way, if you like. It's this anonymous character that, again, maybe invites us into the narrative to imagine ourselves as that person.
One of the witnesses.
Shall we turn to John?
Yes.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
The first thing I'm going to say is that this John reading, John 21 to 18, actually seems to have quite some Markan aspects in the running. Well, you know, the speed and imperative behind the flavour of Mark's gospel is here in John. Mary ran, and then the two others were running, and then one disciple outran Peter.
Yes.
There's a real drama and urgency here.
Yeah, there really is. And I do find this so amusing because I feel like there's a tension in John's text because remembering John's gospel has this beloved disciple, as he's known, that referred to as the one whom Jesus loved. So this loved disciple, beloved disciple, which some people think might be John himself. But there's a tension between wanting to elevate the beloved disciple who has some key moments in the narrative of John, but then also preserving this tradition we've already seen in 1 Corinthians 15, that Peter entered the tomb first. And so there's a running and the beloved disciple gets there first, but he waits and lets Peter go first, and then Peter goes first and then he goes in. And, it's a tad ridiculous, but anyway.
But you can also see the element of sight that you've mentioned already coming in here, and that each disciple as they go in sees a bit more than the last one.
Yes. Peter sees the linen wrappings
and he didn't go in. Simon Peter followed him and he saw the wrappings and that the cloth that had been on Jesus' head wasn't there, but rolled in a place by itself. And then the other disciple went in and saw and believed. So he saw even more such that he believed. Although then there's that enigmatic second part of that sentence.
In verse 9.
For as yet they did not understand the scripture.
Yes, that he would be, that he must be risen, or he must be raised, probably. So it is, verse 9 and 10 are a tad confusing to me because then they all go home and they're in Jerusalem, so they don't have houses there, but maybe that just means they went back to where they were staying.
But they didn't go, unlike Mark, to tell everybody.
No, not at this point. Mary will do that.
Yes.
Which is partly why we like John's gospel at this point.
Yes.
Not that we're biased at all.
Was there anything else in that first section?
No, but I think, and again, this is a theme in John, but the saw and believed, and of course pointing ahead. So one of the reasons, I do think it's the year of Mark, it's great to preach Mark 16, but one of the reasons to perhaps preach this text is that next week is John 20, 19 and Thomas. You know, the faith of Thomas, that story of Jesus appearing behind locked doors, where again we're going to get this riffing on blessed are those who haven't seen and believe. So the sight and belief pairing is quite important, and you could start to unpack that here potentially. We should talk about Mary though, because then the scene shifts in verse 11 to Mary weeping. So again, we've got strong emotion. And, you know, if she's weeping, you know, the assumption here is they've taken, and she says it later on, they've taken my Lord away, that someone's stolen the body. And, of course, she encounters Jesus.
But doesn't recognize him.
No. So we're going to get various resurrection appearances in the lectionary by the various gospel writers over the next few weeks. But there's something about Jesus that means he's both recognisable and not.
Yes.
Yeah.
So clearly a person.
Yep.
But partly to her not recognisable because the whole thing's so...
Yeah, perhaps unbelievable. Astonishing.
Well, astonishing, yeah.
Yeah, impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
And she thinks he's the gardener. So his appearance, whatever it is something like a regular guy. That she can mistake him for a gardener.
I do want to point out an important thing about the two angels that
yes.
Rowan Williams draws to our attention, that the two angels in white either side of the tomb echo the Ark of the Covenant or the mercy seat in the Book of Exodus Ark of the Covenant. So as you all know, the Ark of the Covenant's the gold receptacle. That contains the Ten Commandments, and there's two cherubim on top of it and then a seat, a mercy seat, and God's presence is understood to be in that seat between the two figures.
Yeah.
And this is carried into battle, the presence of God carried with the people. And here we have the echoing of those two figures in the tomb, but it's empty. So there's this paradox here, a profound one, isn't there, around this is the presence of God in the absence. So, you know, you can play with what the cross...
Or is it saying the presence of God was here but now it's gone out?
Yes. I mean, it is also echoing. I think for the Jews we know you don't do imagery of God, and that's partly why
there's an absence here. There's a visual gap here.
Or here's the presence of God's mercy and grace... but the absence of our projection of what we think that looks like.
Yeah.
I don't know. You could.
No, but there's a whole theme there to play with, again, that gets around trying to explain any kind of mechanics of resurrection, but just simply in thinking of it in terms of there's various ways the tradition has thought about God's presence and the, you know, symbols that accompany that.
Well, he's not here. So and, don't look here.
Yeah. The thing that really strikes me in this reading as a possible theme is the naming. So when Mary doesn't recognize the gardener, or at first at least, visually, Jesus says her name. He simply says Mary, this one word. Mm. First word the risen Jesus says. Oh, no, he has already asked her, woman, why are you weeping? But Mary, and it's then that she seems to recognize him and responds with Rabboni, helpfully tells us, which means teacher. Mm. And I think this is significant for two reasons, in that there's recognition in being named, and our names are so important. So I was listening to a lecture actually Rowan Williams gave that's on YouTube, where he was talking about human identity and what makes us human, and told this story of there was a medieval story of a witch who had a son and cursed him at birth, and the curse was to not ever give him a name. The child did not get named, which she said, you know, and there's a whole long story that goes with us, but that not being given a name was considered the worst curse that could happen to you, because without a name you don't have identity. So there's something here about Jesus knowing our name, and that in being named by God we find an identity, but also that in her responding with my teacher, she recognizes her identity as disciple. If you're calling someone teacher, you are their disciple. So the recognition, not only does she recognize Jesus, but she recognizes exactly who she is in relation to Jesus.
That's really profound.
So that's a whole sort of sermon just in that moment, I think.
And with that language around name as well, in a couple of weeks through the Easter season, we'll hear in the Gospel of, in Acts, that's the power of the name of Jesus, that all this stuff is done, that the proclamation is made, that the healings are done. So this whole notion of the power of the name, or his name particularly, obviously, is echoed through there as well.
Yep.
But that relationality of recognition, I think, is really quite a profound thing to point out. And
is something unique to John's version? Yeah. So if you are going to preach on John, that's one of the sort of standout distinctly, distinct moments in this text. The other thing I would note is at the end of this passage, we again get testimony language. So that's everywhere here, this what I proclaim to you, that kind of stuff. We get told Mary Magdalene went out and announced to the disciples. So unlike Mark, where there is fear and silence, John kind of... he's later than Mark, makes this a more successful story in a way. Mary Magdalene does go out and announce to the disciples, and this takes us back to Corinthians. Her announcement is, I have seen the Lord.
I have seen not anything describing how or
And he looked like this. No, or... just I have seen him.
Yep.
That's the testimony. So again, if we're testifying to the resurrection of Jesus in terms of that resurrection presence, I think there's a whole sermon theme in, you know, when have we seen the Lord and how can we speak?
Yeah. And one last thing I might just point out too is that the word resurrection doesn't appear in these texts per se, that it's we can get hung up on the mechanics on trying to prove the general possibility of resurrection when actually this is a specific rising of Jesus. But the resurrection language was used retrospectively to describe the experience.
Yeah.
So, and that's not to get, that's just provides great freedom to think more creatively and transformingly about what's being talked about here.
Yep.
Appearing, the ongoing presence of the risen Christ.
Wonderful. So go tell preachers, proclaim the good news, and that Christ is risen. Happy Easter.
Risen indeed.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.